This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Christian music has been popular, well, for a couple of thousand years now. It continues to evolve to reach new audiences. The modern evangelical movement in this country has spawned the latest incarnation called contemporary Christian music. It traces its roots back to the counterculture movement in the late 1960s. CCM has broken into the mainstream over the past few years. Groups like Mercy Me, Jars of Clay, and DC Talk collect acclaim from critics in Rolling Stone, Billboard magazine, and the Los Angeles Times, to name just a few. Christian music has its own radio network, its own record labels, and its own award show. Contemporary Christian music no longer just preaches to the choir. If you've noticed a more religious message in your daily dose of Top 40 or find yourself worshiping to rock, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. To get a better understanding of just what contemporary Christian music is, we turn to Jay Howard. He's the co-author of Apostles of Rock, The Splintered World of Contemporary Christian Music. He's also an associate professor of sociology at Indiana University, Purdue University, Columbus, and he joins us from his office in Columbus. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Neil, a pleasure to be joining you from sunny Indiana.
Ah, well, nice. Glad for you that it's nice there. In your book, you divide CCM into three subgenres based not on the type of music they play, but on their relationship between, or how they see their relationship between Christianity and culture.
That's exactly right, Neil. John Streck and I set out to do a sociocultural mapping of the genre of contemporary Christian music because it's a genre that's featured a lot of sort of sniping from one group at another, largely over debates about authenticity, about what really is Christian music. And we argue that there isn't one contemporary Christian music genre, but there are really three based upon what they see as the ideal relationships between Christians and their surrounding cultures.
And you identify one as separationists. Who are those?
The separational contemporary Christian music performers tend to see themselves as ministers or possibly musical missionaries. They see surrounding culture as something that is evil or corrupt, from which Christians need to separate themselves. So what they're seeking to do with their music, by and large, is either to convert people, so it's a very evangelistic sort of music, a lot of proselytizing going on, or to build up those who already believe. So one of the early Christian rock bands, Petro, the primary songwriter, was fond of saying that he wrote musical Bible studies. And they also seek to facilitate worship, which has been a big phenomenon in evangelical churches around the United States today, that the churches that are growing the most are those that tend to use contemporary worship music.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these artists, therefore, are trying to reach out and convert people, but trying to pull them out of the mainstream culture into a Christian subculture.
Now, there's another group you identify as the integrationalist. Who are those?
The integrational people tend to define themselves as entertainers, as John and I argue. In their view, they see surrounding culture not so much as evil, but at least in its highest ideals, surrounding culture is very consistent with the highest ideals of Christianity. So rather than seeking to convert people, what you need to do, in their view, is offer sort of a wholesome alternative to the excesses of popular music. So you get people like Amy Grant doing a wholesome pop, and for a long time, you know, Christian parents have argued they'd rather have their kids listening to Amy Grant than, say, Madonna, or listening to DC Talk rather than listening to Eminem.
Mm-hmm.
So in their view, you don't really need to be very overtly religious. What you need to do is perform more of a positive pop, sort of a wholesome alternative to what goes on in the mainstream.
And there's the third group is what you call the transformationalists.
The transformationalists see themselves as artists, Neil, and they take their cues from the first chapter of the first book of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, where it says men and women are created in the image of God. Well, what's God doing in Genesis chapter 1? He's creating the world. So in the view of these transformational artists, simply being creative, the act of being creative itself, is something that is inherently Christian or inherently divine. So rather than needing to use your music in a utilitarian sort of fashion to convert people like the separational ministers tend to do, the transformational artists say simply being creative is in itself a Christian activity. Now, as a result, their music tends to be brutally honest. Things aren't always wrapped up by the end of the third verse with a nice happy ending where I became a Christian and everything is great now, which sometimes tends to happen with the separational ministers, that they can talk about hard times, but by the third verse, everything's happy again. Mm. Well, with the transformational artists, they might end on a down note. As a matter of fact, one band, the 77s, for example, did an entire album that focused on the divorce of the lead singer-songwriter. That is a brutally honest CD called Drowning with Land in Sight, which is probably the first Christian CD ever to focus on the theme of divorce.
Yeah, I was going to say, if he might have been a separationist, if I'm getting this right, they would have gotten remarried.
Right, they would have gotten or they would have, you know, preserved their marriage in the first place, right, mm-hmm. without ever having to go through the divorce process.
If you'd like to get in our conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And let's talk to Mike, who's with us on the line from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes, good afternoon, Neil. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and I listen to you every day.
Well, thanks very much.
When I was a teenager in the 60s, rock was evil. It was preached from the pulpit, and not just the lyrics, but just the music. And I find it, interesting, maybe hypocritical, that now the very same genre that was so evil and looked upon in my youth is now touted as such a great, wonderful thing. And I'm wondering how much of that has to do with the business aspects of Christianity. I'm a former pastor and preached the same topic from the pulpit, and this is something that has been kind of a concern to me. The trending towards Gomorrah, so to speak, of Christianity.
Jay Howard?
John and I devote an entire chapter in our book to that very topic of how rock was vilified early in the days of contemporary Christian music. And we argue a lot of the arguments against rock as being a valid musical form for Christian worship in many ways are rooted in racism. They go back, if you read some of those early books that came out in the 60s, they talk about heathen jungle music, you know, which is a subtle racist sort of thing going on. They also make some outrageous claims about, you know, backward masking in records, you know, which, you know, is a whole other topic. I mean, Led Zeppelin was accused of that as well as the Eagles and others.
Secret messages on records. Yeah,
right,
okay, I get
right.
it.
You play the record backwards, the only way you can hear the message. And there's no scientific evidence that playing the record forward, you can get that message. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So there's no evidence to support that whatsoever. But I really don't think it is so much money-driven. I think it's more demographically driven as a sociologist. What has happened is that the rock generation has grown up, and the rock generation is now the elders and the pastors of those churches. And they find that it is more of the rock-oriented music that facilitates a worship experience or a subjective religious experience, if you want to put it in social science terms, for them. So it does it much better than, say, a pipe organ does.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's really a matter of the people who now control the churches are people who grew up listening to rock, and to them it's not evil. It's a part of their youth and part of a musical genre that has spoken to them for decades.
I think Larry Norman, who's some call the Elvis of Christian music, took a rather amusing take on just your point, Mike. He wrote a song called Why Should All the Devil Get All the Good Music? Let's listen to a little bit of it.
I want the people to know that he saved my soul, but I still like to listen to the radio. They say rock and roll is wrong, we'll give you one more chance. I say I feel so good, I gotta get up and dance. I know what's right, I know what's wrong, I don't confuse it. All I'm really trying to say is why should the devil have all the good music?
So, Mike, does that answer your question?
Pretty much so.
Okay. Thanks very much for the phone call.
You might be interested in knowing that Larry Norman song, what Norman is actually doing is he's paraphrasing William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army, who said something to the effect, Why Should the Devil Have All the Good Tunes, and did his big band music, sort of marching band music, with his founding of the Salvation Army. But Booth was actually quoting Martin Luther himself, who made a very similar statement that it's inappropriate for the devil to have all the good music. So we find in various generations, whatever sorts of musical innovations hit the church, they are typically viewed very skeptically early on, and only as that generation grows and ages and begins to control the institutional structures of the church do those new musical forms become the status quo.
Let's get another caller in. This is Will, who's with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I was wondering what your person there thinks about the Resurrection Band, who was back in the 80s. Looked upon very skeptically because they were very hardcore rock and roll, and also about when Dylan and Richie Furay crossed over from their broad kind of music to do their religious albums.
Mm-hmm.
I think Resurrection Band is a fascinating example, as you may or may not know, that Resurrection Band comes from an intentional religious community in Chicago called Jesus People USA. And Resurrection Band arguably was the very first Christian heavy metal band or hard rock band, and they created a lot of waves in the late 1970s, early 1980s with their first few albums. But they were very separational in their approach and continue to be today. The lead singer-songwriter Glenn Kaiser has said in interviews that at times perhaps the band was even too utilitarian, using the music only to convert people rather than valuing the music in itself. And he's softened his stance on that somewhat. And Res Band and Jesus People USA sponsor one of the biggest Christian music festivals in the nation, the Cornerstone Festival, which happens in central Illinois during the 4th of July weekend.
If you wonder what Christian heavy metal might sound like, here's the 80s heavy metal band Stryper with To Hell with the Devil. Again, that's the band Stryper. You just heard the name of the tune. Jay Howard, where do you see, as you look at the sniping amongst these various groups that you talked about, and by the way, Will, thanks very much for the call, a lot of it has to do with their attitudes towards commercialism, doesn't it?
I think that's true. All of these subgenres, and this is really my co-author John Streck's area of expertise, all of them must deal with the constraints of an industry. They all have to sell a certain amount of CDs in order to be able to continue to make their music. And so, therefore, you know, you end up making compromises, and none of them get to do quite exactly what they'd really like to do all the time. So, for example, you have Larry Norman, who started off on secular labels, on Capitol Records and MGM, and felt he was being censored too much and started his own record label, which was then distributed by a Christian record company.
Mm-hmm.
Stryper's a bit unusual in that, well, they started a sort of a heavy metal revolution, a subgenre that came to be known as white metal, but they started on a what we would call a mainstream heavy metal label, even though they were quickly embraced by CCM, and did such things as tour with Motley Crue on the Heaven and Hell tour, when you'd have Stryper coming out first, throwing Bibles into the crowd, and then be followed up with Motley Crue, who was often vilified by Christians.
Well, Jay Howard, thanks very much.
A pleasure joining you.
Jay Howard, co-author of Apostles of Rock, The Splintered World of Contemporary Christian Music, a professor of sociology at Indiana University, Purdue University, Columbus, and we appreciate his time today. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. To get an industry perspective on Christian music, joining us now is Jay Schwarzendruber, managing editor of CCM Magazine. He's with us from his office in Nashville, and good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you so much. It's definitely an honor to be joining you guys, and I just got to say, you're really taking me down memory lane here. This is fun.
Oldies, eh?
I am 36 years old, and I've been a Christian music fan for more than 20 years now.
Well, as we're hearing, there's an awful lot of different genres. What exactly is CCM?
Well, CCM is, of course, stands for Contemporary Christian Music, and simply put, it's the only genre of music that's defined by its lyrics. I would say it's kind of a man-made box. The purist in me would say that Christian music is actually any music that's created from a Christian perspective. Of course, that would throw in, you know, bands like U2 and legendary artists like Johnny Cash. But from the industry has, thanks to maybe even too strong of a marketing arm, taken the definition and based it on the lyrics and who distributes the album.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, U2 has done faith-based music for, you know, since 1980, and if they suddenly got Christian market distribution tomorrow, you know what? As far as our industry is concerned, they'd be Christian music.
Now, how big a business is this?
Well, it's getting bigger and bigger every year. For instance, in 2003, Christian market albums accounted for 7% of all album sales. It's almost a $1 billion industry just in the U.S. alone. That came about with 47.1 million albums being sold just in that past year, 2003. Mm-hmm. Sold more than soundtracks, Latin music, and believe it or not, jazz and classical combined.
Let's get another caller in on the conversation. Jack is with us from Three Oaks, Michigan.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I just got a comment. I'm the music director of my church for our youth group, not for the adult service part of for our youth. And I'm 25 years old, and we have a band back there, and I go to a Baptist church, and our church is normally more of a traditional type of church, your hymns and such. But in our youth group, we are more contemporary in the fact that we have our instruments and electric guitar and drums and all that stuff. And we play both contemporary and hymn-based songs, just obviously with a little bit more upbeat to them. And I don't have a problem with either one, but I think in our industry and in our society today is there's a big emphasis on, you know, obviously the money part of it, and I think people cross over, there's a compromise. But in my perspective, if I'm listening to a song that if the band is claiming to be Christian and I can't understand what they're saying or I can't hear what they're saying because of their music, like you played that cut of that record, mm-hmm. To Hell with the Devil, that in no way, shape, or form leads me to worship my Savior, which in Christian music, in my opinion, is your number one goal, is to point towards God, not towards yourself. So I think there's a line that's been crossed, but I think there are people that are doing it the right way, and then there's other people that it's gone, they're trying to draw attention to themselves rather than draw attention to the God that they're supposedly serving. So,
Jack, thanks very much for the call. We'll get a
response
from our guest on the other side of the break. Appreciate it. And Jay Schwartzendruber, can you stay with us 2 minutes?
Absolutely.
And we'll get a response to Jack's comment when we come back from a short break. If you'd like to get involved in the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, Ira Flatow's here with the next Science Friday. He'll have a conversation with author David Lindley about the Victorian scientist William Thomson, perhaps better known as Lord Kelvin. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Today we're discussing the growing popularity of contemporary Christian music, and our guest is Jay Schwartzendruber. He's the managing editor of CCM Magazine. He's with us from his office in Nashville. And Jay, just before the break, we had a caller on talking about some flaws which he detected, he saw in the marketing of Christian music.
Sure thing, Neil. I got to say, I really, really connected with the caller in so many ways. He actually reminded me of myself many years ago. His view actually was really prevalent during the 1980s and on into the 90s in much of the both Christian music fandom and the Christian music community. What's happened, though, is that as Christian music has become more sophisticated, artists have embraced what I would probably call a more broad theology of art. They've come to see music as less utilitarian. They see music now as less of something you just use to evangelize and share the gospel are just to worship. For instance, artists would now say that, you know, man, singing a song, calling people to respond to the African AIDS crisis is just as important as, you know, any other song that might be labeled as Christian. And songs about purity in sexual relationships, songs about, you know, loving your neighbor, that it's not a utilitarian thing. It's about goodness, truth, and beauty. That's where the bottom line is. And that's kind of what you're starting to see now, that the view that he had and that I had several years ago is much less prevalent now. And frankly, I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled because I think it really opens the doors for dialogue and really important conversation.
Here's an email we got from Robert in Salt Lake City, Utah. I've been a Christian music fan for a few years now, mostly because of a desire I have to listen to music that doesn't promote sex, drugs, and or violence. Something I really enjoy of late, especially since I DJ for church-sponsored dances, is Christian rap. And I was wondering if your guest could comment on this so-called holy hip-hop. We have an example before we get your comment, Jay, and this is from an artist called Kanye West, and it's Jesus Walks.
Now hear me, wanna see thee more clearly. I know he hear me when my feet get weary, cause we're the almost nearly extinct. We rappers as role models, we rap, we don't think. I ain't here to argue about his facial features, or here to convert atheists into believers. I'm just trying to say the way school need teachers, the way Kathy needed Regis, that's the way I need Jesus. So here go my single, doll, radio needs this. They said you could rap about anything except for Jesus. That means guns, sex, lies, video tape. But if I talk about God, my record won't get played, huh? Well, if this take away from my...
Jay Schwartz and Druber, a couple of things there, one of which is that form almost seems tailor-made for that message, and he's also echoing the idea that a lot of Christian artists have, that if they become overtly Christian, their records aren't going to get played.
Right. Now, it's interesting. I just have to say there's a real irony here, Neil, because Kanye West, actually, I think it's safe to say, would not consider himself a contemporary Christian hip-hop artist. There's definitely a strong sense of a profound faith in Christ, but if you look at his lyrics, he has no problem with profanity. So I think it's safe to say that he's not in any way trying to, you know, lock in Christian market distribution per se. So I just wanted to kind of get that out there.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, Christian hip-hop is definitely a form that has been increasingly popular over the last several years. Probably the most popular group would be a group called Grits. Their name stands for Grammatical Revolution of the Spirit, and their most recent album came out 2 years ago, and it sold over 125,000 copies. They've been embraced by BET, MTV2, and with their new release, Dichotomy A, coming up here in several weeks, there's a really real feeling that they may be the first real breakout artist into the mainstream from the Christian community.
Well, Jay Schwartz and Druber, thanks very much. Jay Schwartz and Druber is managing editor of CCM Magazine. He was with us from his office in Nashville, Tennessee. With us now, Jim Bryson. He's been playing Christian music professionally for over a decade. Many critics believe his band, Mercy Me, may open the floodgates for Christian music to go mainstream. Their new CD, Undone, debuted at number 12, right below Norah Jones on Billboard's top 200 best-selling albums. Their first CD went platinum, and their hit, I Can Only Imagine, startled the mainstream music industry by topping Christian, adult, contemporary, and pop charts. And Jim Bryson, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So do you see music as a spiritual calling, or is it your profession, or is it both?
It's definitely both. I feel, and everyone in the group feels, that we're called to do this as a ministry. It just so happens to be a ministry with music and not necessarily just speaking. And so it's definitely a calling, but at the same time, you know, we're able to make a living and support our families doing it.
We have an email from Tamara in San Diego. I've been trying to explain to my friends why I, as an atheist, love certain Christian performers. I love everything from Johnny Cash to the Reverend Charlie Jackson to alternative performers like Soul Junk and the Danielson family. And why not? I listen to whatever's good, and good music usually comes from deep emotions. Would that characterize some of your music, do you think?
Yeah. You know, I've talked to people before, and they've said, well, why do you do what you do? And I say, well, we're called to do this, and we write about life experiences and what matters to us. You know, Marilyn Manson might write about, you know, sex in a song, and, you know, whatever group writes about just what consumes them, and we are totally consumed by Christ. And so not every song necessarily is blatant and you know uses the word Jesus and Christ in every you know every other sentence, but they're along the same theme, and you know whether it's from our perspective or from maybe a non-Christian's perspective, but we try to incorporate everything that we believe in.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned your hit song earlier, this Imagine from Mercy Me. Let's take a listen to a bit of it.
I can only imagine what it will be like when I walk by your side. I can only imagine what my eyes will see when your face is before me. I can only imagine.
And Jim Bryson, the song had sort of an interesting history. It had a very successful run on Christian radio stations and on the Christian charts, but then it had another life. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it pretty much took off, you know, in a way that we never thought would ever happen, never even looked for it to happen. There was a station in Dallas that played the song kind of on a dare, and they were kind of a racy morning show, and they played it, and within about 5 minutes, their phone lines were flooded. People wanted to know who played the song, so they played it again later on, and the same thing happened, and people were driving to the station because they couldn't get through on the phone lines to find out, you know, who had done the song, and within 2 days, it was the number one song on their station, and it stayed that way for several months. And so a couple of record labels and record execs heard about it, and so got to talking to our label about it, and they were on the mainstream side, and it was Curb Records out of Nashville. And so we were able to work a deal with them to use their marketing expertise in the mainstream market, and you know, did a few test markets, and it went really well, so we released it nationwide, and I think it made it up, I think, to number 4 on the AC pop charts mainstream. So it did, you know, extremely well, and we always kind of joke because it's such a blatant Christian song. It's one of the top 5 songs we thought would never cross over, so it kind of shows, you know, we don't necessarily all know what we're talking about, and it shows how much that people are really yearning to hear something like that.
I understand at one point you guys told your record label, hey, don't ask us to write another pop hit.
Well, you know, it's kind of one of those things. It's hard, you know, when you come out nationally with your first signed album. We had 6 independents before that, but this is the first time with national distribution. And when you come out and have a song of the year in the Christian market and sell X amount of albums and whatever, it's kind of hard to follow that up. And so there was some pressure on us and pressure on the record label, and just everybody in the industry was really going to watch what was happening. And we certainly didn't want to try to write something along the same lines and try to you know, feed from that same vein. We wanted to write what we were feeling and living at the time, and so our second album, Spoken For, still had a couple of number one songs off that, but we're you know, in a totally different vein.
We're speaking with Jim Bryson. He plays keyboards for the band Mercy Me. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Dan, who's with us from Pleasanton, California.
Hello, Neil. Thank you.
Sure.
There's a theme I've been interested in for some time that I've noticed in popular music, and I guess for those of us old enough to remember, George Harrison and some of his lyrics are a good example.
My Sweet Lord, yeah.
And that is, well, not another song on that album I'm thinking of, and the theme that appears in a lot of his music, and that is the distinction between organized religion and either faith or spirituality. You know, there are a number of lyrics, for example, not just his music, but I'm remembering, for example, there's a lyric in one of his songs, well, the Pope owns 51% of General Motors, and the stock exchange is the only thing he's qualified to quote us. The Lord is awaiting on you all to awaken and see. That sort of thing, which I took to be promoting the idea that, you know, organized religion perhaps isn't that useful or isn't that positive, but there are some wonderful things in the whole realm of spirituality and faith that we should pay attention to. And I'm wondering if that theme is popping up in the music you're talking about.
Jim Bryson, is that something you would recognize?
You know, it's an interesting question because I'm a huge Beatles fan and love George Harrison also. And I think they had some interesting views. They had some views, you know, from the Hare Krishna side. And I'm sorry,
right.
Not Hare Krishna, but you know what I'm talking about. And
yeah. Well, mixing various religious traditions.
Yeah. I mean, they tried a lot of different things. And I think there is a difference between faith and organized religion. I think the benefit of organized religion, whether it's a denomination or even a non-denominational church, is the benefit of fellowship. Just spending time with other believers and talking about, you know, you might have a problem and you don't realize, you know, there might be some other people out there, and just discussing it and what to do, and having people that are more wise, you know, particularly about the Bible and its contents, teaching you about it, and just, you know, fellowship. And I think it's, there are some distorted views, and of course you can look at anything in the world from, you know, two different perspectives, but I think as a whole, organized religion is fine. I do think there are problems. It's no different than the government. You know, you can look at it, it's without the government, it would be, you know, pretty interesting, but at the same time, there's some, you know, departments of the government I think we all question. And I think as long as the organized religion is not doing any, you know, anything hateful or, you know, detrimental, I think, you know, I think it's a good thing.
Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
And let's see if we get one more caller in. Brent is with us from Sacramento.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Brent.
Yeah, I'm just, this is more of a comment than a question. I kind of feel like that the industry is being increasingly taken over by secular companies and being run by these secular companies and being having to adhere more to a secular business model, and with quarterly business reports and things like that. And to me, it's taking a great deal away from the ministerial aspects of what these good artists are trying to do, in that fact that the companies are now finding artists that are doing the quick fix kind of things. I think Mercy Me is a good example of the contrary, and I'm glad of that. But by and large, their models are more based on the secular models, and it's a quick hit and out, one and done kind of thing.
Is that something you worried about when you were picked up by the Nashville label, Jim?
No, because we talked to Jeff Mosley, who's the president of INO Records. We really told him what we were about and our ministry, and we said, you know, the only way we're going to do this is if, you know, we have X amount of say and X amount of control and whatever, and he more than gave us, you know, way more than the fair amount. And so he gives us final say on what we need. You know, obviously we trust him thoroughly in the business world because he's been around so much longer than us. But as far as, you know, if there's something we don't feel right, or if there's a suggestion, you know, to try to change this and we think, no, we want to keep it, you know, more blatant or whatever, that's fine. But very, very seldom that I know of personally do record labels try to get Christian artists to change lyrics or anything like that. Now, I will agree that most of the record labels, except for a couple, are owned, you know, by other mm-hmm. businesses and so forth, but there are still Christian people running them for the most part at the actual labels. Now, the ownership of the other companies, you know, might be different, but it's one of those things. I think a lot of the stuff, especially stylistically, is mimicking a lot of what is in the mainstream, but I think it has to in order to be able to compete. On this last album, where our budget was probably three or four times what the previous one was, and we decided, you know, we were going to make it sound exactly what like you would hear on mainstream radio. We even had the London Symphony play on it in Abbey Road Studios.
Jim Bryson, this is a cut from your Mercy Me's most recent album, Undone. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
This is called Here With Me. Well, Ira Flatto will be here with you tomorrow on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. We'll see you Monday. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News in Washington.